Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us again on our fifth podcast. I think I keep getting the numbers wrong, Samreen, but I think this is our fifth podcast. How are you today?
I'm okay. I'm really excited that we've done five podcasts. I can't believe that.
I know, that is good, isn't it? And really, really insightful conversations you and I have been having with our guests as well. I'm really pleased to hear that they've really hit the spot for some of our listeners as well. So what we decided to do today is just do a sort of a poster bag. That's a bit of a retro, I feel a bit of the sort of 80s, 90s from the radio. But we thought we'd do a sort of listen to some of your comments, some of our listeners' comments and questions around the four topics that we've really picked upon, and which is great. So thank you for all the engagement from everybody. So shall we dive straight in? And there's a couple that you and I have picked out regarding access to education, which was our first topic. And that was really the place, the topic that we first met on, really, wasn't it, Samreen?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting, actually. I just read an article recently. 75% of exam officers said there would not be enough competent exam officers for this summer's exams, and we're in the middle of those now. So it's been good to hear some of our listeners' experiences. There's a positive one, Samreen.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. What is it? I'm so excited.
So, a story from Don. Was really just sharing his experience with his child, having access arrangements put in place by their school. And they felt the school was really understanding, really did as much as they could to ensure the environment for their child was as effective as possible to help the child meet their potential in their exams. And that's what this is all about, isn't it? Access arrangements has become this sort of aspect of, oh, we just got to fit this child, you know, they want a separate room, they want it becomes something that's quite challenging for the school. So it's lovely to hear from Don that actually the school really understood that this is quite emotional for everybody involved.
Yeah, I think that's really lovely, because I think for a lot of parents, access arrangements can feel like a battle to get it right. And those stories really stand out, and we have those experiences of everything that needs to go in. So when you hear a really positive story, when you hear that actually it's worked well and how it's worked, it shows that there are lots of stories where the right access arrangements can be put in place, and they are in place, and that young person has the ability to take the exam, which means that they have the best outcome possible for themselves. So I'm really happy. That's a great story.
Yeah, so really pleased. So thank you so much for getting in touch with that. Jez has asked, we discussed in the podcast, obviously, we try to put forward our thoughts on solutions to things, which is always, it's just sort of blue skying, really, isn't it? And the power, the little power we have, but obviously we're trying to give a voice to these issues. What do we feel would be the future of access arrangements, considering the challenges schools are having this year and colleges are having this year to actually put access arrangements in place? We put forward around local authorities, making sure there's a duty for local authorities to ensure all students had access to an exam venue that was suitable for them. I don't know where your current thinking is on this, Samreen.
So there's been some stuff in the newspapers and articles being written about the change in regulations to allow children who are ill to be able to take exams. There's some changes happening there, some really important changes, so that it's, because one of the things we spoke about, Esther, when we first met, was how difficult it was for children who were ill, and that's how we met, because I had a student who was disabled who couldn't, you know, how would she sit her exams, or what do we do in those circumstances? So, and can you award grades when that doesn't happen? So there is some changes around that, and you're quite on top of it with all of that. And my only thought is I hope it's not a fight to prove how ill you are in order to access those kind of grades. So that's my only worry about that. But I think it's positive that change is happening, and that's what we have to be really pleased with.
I agree, Samreen. Good that things are moving forward. Another layer on this, I think that obviously is something that we're having to look at because we work with JCQ around the facilitation of exams, is AI. Now, pre-COVID, there was a real starting of a movement towards computer-based testing and e-examination, which for students who have additional needs was had potential to become something that would give them an opportunity, a wider opportunity around access to qualifications. Now, AI, great. You know, there's a tool here that education experts are looking at how we can use it and leverage it for positive outcomes. However, the current sort of message coming from the Department for Education is that exams, high stakes exams in a hall, are the only way that we can assure ourselves that a student's work is authentic. Personally, I think that's a real step backwards, and also a real step backward for students who have some form of access arrangement requirement, because it again is limiting the ability for students to move forward to take an exam when it's that inner hall, large hall. You know, the whole environment doesn't suit a large number of students now. So I think we have that tension now between digital and tech advancement, and then the advancement of students' needs and emotional needs.
I think that the whole topic around AI and exams is probably something we should talk about at another time anyway, because it is so interesting, and the impact that is having on exams. And actually, when we're in an opportunity where we could be changing and opening things, AI is almost forcing us to close down and make things like almost build a wall around it to protect this kind of exam space. So there is a tension there between things moving on in some ways in a good way, but in other ways we don't quite trust what this is doing. Because I've had some students this year who've been able who it's been easier to organize their exams for them to take them at home. So there are some things which are happening, which are changing, but you just talking about the AI makes me feel like, oh, this is all going to be closed down again soon. Like we've had this sort of opening and things will be changing. So every time we make a bit of progress with exams, we then something else then becomes makes it a bit more difficult. I think we have to
I'm
watch this
hopeful.
space.
I think we'll touch on this topic. I was going to start to delve more into it, but let's note that as an area, and we can see if we can invite a guest on, and I'm sure our listeners would be intrigued with that as well. So we'll note that one down. Great. So our second week's topic, what topic was, I'm going to call it the title we sort of get contentiously gave it, which is school refusal. And then we obviously then did discuss how that can seem a very negative and blame heavy title. And we talked about anxiety related absence. The latest data in April was that 140,000 children in the UK are severely absent. So this isn't going away, unfortunately. So we have had, and I know this is an area you have really sort of good thoughts around, Samreen. We've had a person contact us called May, who said they're very upsetting for them and their child who's now suddenly not attending school. Listened to the podcast and just had some sort of questions, comments around where they can get support and anything we can say that would, you know, each child's situation and factors are so unique, but is there anything we can say that might give some support to May?
Firstly, May, I'm sorry that to hear that you're going through this, because I think it is stressful for parents, and for the child involved when this starts to happen. And Esther, as you were just saying, there's such a large amount of young people who are in this same boat, and so many of them are on part-time school timetables. Many can't even come in on a full day. And I think it is a long process. It's not something that's solved overnight. But I think the important thing, first of all, is it's really important that you as parents don't feel judged. You're not failing your child because you can't get them into school, but equally, your child shouldn't feel judged either, because there's something behind this. It's not a kind of waking up one day and deciding, I don't want to go to school anymore. And I think that's the first most important thing, is to remember that this is about finding the right help that works for your child, and it's not a one size fits all. It's very much moves within what your child's needs are. I think secondly, I would say what's really important, that actually, ironically, even though the child might feel as if I don't want to go to school anymore, is relinquishing all responsibility, they do still want some control. So they should still
Yes.
feel like they've got some control over their education, whether that is their, you asking them in the morning, "Are you ready to go to school today?" And they say, "No, I'm not." And then you're saying, "Okay, that's fine. I'll ask you again maybe at 12 o'clock." But they're the ones who have control. But you're not giving up on it either. You're meeting them. You're creating a framework around them. So that whenever I've worked with children who are really anxious about coming to school, it's always worked best when I've helped them feel that they're in control of this process.
That's wonderful, Sunmi. That's really, I think that would be really powerful for somebody to hear that. So thank you for sharing that.
And I think lastly, what I should say is that just a reminder that you're not on your own with this. You feel on your own because in the house it's you and your child, but actually use the school as support, whatever framework you've got around you, that's your network. And it's important that as parents you feel really supported. But once they're able to come back into school, you've got the local authority, you've got the school, you've got any charities or anyone who's able to step in and support around that. So there is support out there, and use the school for that.
Yeah, very good. Good advice. And it links into something another listener, Nick, said, which is what they found useful about the podcast episode, is just reframing school refusal. I'm doing sort of, in the air, as something about anxiety. And if you, and taking away that blame. And I like the section you said about the process. It's not something that's going to change very quickly. It's that patience that everyone who's involved with that child needs to have, and the child themselves, just being gentle with themselves as well.
Absolutely. I mean, as education is about the long game. It's
Yeah.
about where you get to at the end. And sometimes you make it about, but you should have got there by next week. And look, everyone's moved there by the end of the year. And actually, for all of us, we've probably all got a story to tell how we got to where we were in the long
Yeah.
game. We didn't get there straight. So, and that's what you're helping your child. That goal is there. It just might take a bit longer to get there.
That's lovely. Thank you very much. And I'm sure that will resonate and be supportive to a number of our listeners who are facing that, or know people who are dealing with that. Again, a topic we perhaps come back to at some point, because I think it's a really powerful one, and one that for those people sort of facing it can be quite emotional. So, and obviously let us know, anyone, if you have any questions regarding that area. Our third podcast was Dr. Helen Afeni. So mindfulness, that I really enjoyed that. It was lovely, obviously, for us to sit back and listen to somebody who's really passionate about an area that they're involved in education. And also I like the idea we were taking it back into the area of teachers and their role in education, such a vital element towards the culture they set in their classroom, and the modelling they do around how children are about themselves and how they are with each other. And we have had a comment from a teacher who is using mindfulness in the classroom, and some of the techniques that Dr. Helen Afeni referred to. Perhaps they'd had her book in their back pocket, who knows? But just really talking about the power of that, and how they'd seen a little shift, in the student's behaviour. Are there any techniques that you are aware of, or that you have heard are successful, sort of to put in place in the classroom? Or anything? I think we were also talking about, so two-point question. I feel I'm firing questions at you, Sammy. This is unfair, really. We also talked about teachers' education and CPD, and where teachers can access ADHD, sorry, mindfulness support. So I'm just wondering whether there's two parts to that, really. Are there any techniques you feel And also, is there anything that teachers and teacher education can do regarding mindfulness in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of that, I think in terms of techniques that we've heard teachers use or we've used in the classroom, is actually taking a moment at the start of the lesson to just sort of to speak with the young person and to kind of ask them how they're feeling right now, and taking a moment to kind of have a small sort of exercise, whether it's around breathing or whether it's around looking at something as a transition into the work that they're doing. And that really helps. And actually, Esther, the thing that really stood out to me about that, about listening to Helen, was the impact it had both on me and you, where we went, oh, actually, yeah. Meetings, we should be first asking each other and asking our team, how are you right now?
Yes.
You know, before we go into that, are we okay? Are we able to listen? Because if you think about, even take it away from us for a moment, but you think about a secondary school, and if you ever follow a young person through their day, and they're going from geography, and they're going from maths, and they're going from English, and they're zooming around the school from one to another, and they're going through a busy corridor as they go in, and you are in, and you're like, right, we're about to start this subject. Just taking a moment to say, right, let's all think, how are we right now? Are we ready? Can we do some breathing exercises as we go into the lesson? So there's lots of techniques out there, and lots of ways of doing this. And I think teachers are more interested. I'm seeing it more and more in primary schools where they're teaching children mindfulness. I haven't seen that come into secondary schools in the same way.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I agree. And I think everybody should try and think about, put themselves in the shoes of a secondary school student. Yeah. And the pressure that's going, you know, through that day, the emotional roller coaster that child is on. I really like the idea of that we talked about it, as you said, around you just check in with each other. And it's equal, it's equitable.
Yeah.
You know, you're checking in with me, I'm checking in with you.
Yeah.
And I think if a teacher can get to that point, that would be really powerful as well, wouldn't it? If a teacher could get to the point where they're, you know, this is how I'm feeling today. How are you? Are we ready as a group to learn? Are we ready as a group to engage in this? So I think that's something that that's something that I'm sure would resonate well with those who are in education and looking at ways of helping their students prepare themselves for learning for those 30, 45 minutes they have with them.
But Esther, I think that point you just said about being equitable is so important. It's such an honest remark that we all feel a particular way. We're not, just because you might come in as a teacher or you might come in as a manager, it doesn't mean that you are devoid of those feelings or you've come in with something. So we're all on an equal playing field there. And just establishing that, I think, is a cultural shift, I think, in the way we view our own mental health and well-being.
Yes, no, that's it. And how we view the delivery of education.
Yeah.
I think creating that equal space, I think that's really, perhaps that's something we can look at on another.
I think we're moving towards opening a new school. I feel like a new way of, maybe that's what's happening here.
But yeah, I really like that. And it's nice when we talk, isn't it? We sort of bounce these ideas off each other. Lovely. Okay. New school, that's one of our topics. final podcast we had Karen Nash join us, and Karen was really inspiring.
Yeah.
We both felt that, talking about
incredibly.
Her own journey through discovery and a late diagnosis with ADHD, how her childhood was through education and through the lens of education, really, that was mainly what we focused on. And that moment where for her it became really sort of very challenging for her to move forward. And then that whole element of opening up a new area of her life once the diagnosis with their strategies were in place. And she could then move forward to gain a degree, move into teaching, and now into pastoral support. And we had a listener message us about that, Tia. And what was powerful about Tia's message is she said it did inspire her to then talk to her manager. And to sort of expose herself around her own diagnosis. And when we read that, we were both then reflecting on, because we're managers, we have teams, around our approach to that, And I think, you know, from our, Karen Nash actually is in my team, so I've got first-hand experience of somebody, you know, just sort of disclosing something like that. And just how mindful you are, excuse me, of that, how as a manager, you have to really draw on that, those empathetic aspects and think about adaptations you need to make.
Yeah.
If that's in a meeting or if it's in your interactions with that person, to really help them, because it's a really scary space to disclose something about yourself.
Yeah.
And to make it feel that that's fine and we're going to make this a safe space for you and still encourage you to grow as a person in your work environment. I don't know whether you've ever had experience of that or how you feel that might work.
I agree with that, but I think that's what was so beautiful is having Karen speak with you there as someone who manages manages her perhaps or manages the team, and she was so happy and open to share her story, and clearly you really valued that story. And I think it, with me, I also, when you manage a team of people, not everyone's different, and you know, and you want to celebrate those differences. I've had the same experience, and I think what's useful about it is also it helps you understand the whole person a bit more. So if anything happens, or if they do something in a particular way, or they're not managing in a particular way, or you realize they've got a strength, you always can reframe and understand, oh, I understand what's happening here. This has just made sense to me. I know why you've reacted like this. And for that, I feel grateful for knowing. I feel appreciative of knowing. And the more I can accommodate my team members, I can bring the best out of them, the better the team is, but the better the work is. And we're in the business of helping young people, so it all filter through. So
I love that phrase you said, understanding the whole person.
Yeah.
That's because, you know, as you say, everybody's different, but we don't always give time to understand the whole person. And people also don't reveal that.
They don't reveal that. And I think it takes me back to the first time we met, and we were like, oh, here's a little bit of our story each to each other. And it was such a beautiful way of meeting each other. It was like, this is who we are. And then we're like, yes, and this is what we believe in, and this is why we believe in it. And that's a bit like understanding Karen's story. It just made her, it was so incredibly inspiring and helped understand why she was so passionate about her work. And I believe really good at her work.
Yes, very, very. Lovely. Okay, so, as always, really fascinating conversation. I always really enjoy the way we sort of move through these topics. And I can tell our brains are buzzing with things.
Yeah, more ideas, more podcast ideas. And a school.
exactly. Thank you all to our listeners and for their comments, messages. I hope that's been useful just to do a little summary and reflect back on the topics that we've looked at. We're toying with the idea of something around transitions as our next topic, aren't we, Samarine? So it'd be good if anybody has any thoughts or comments on that. You thought that would be quite a useful one to explore.
I would love to talk about transitions. A lot of my understanding around the sort of areas of vulnerability are around transitions and how we manage them, and you know, and how we support and structure them. So I think it's so relevant to education. It's so relevant to young people. So I'm especially excited about talking about this.
Great, good. Okay, so we'll get that one recorded very soon. So thank you, Samarine. Thank you, everybody, for today. And thank you for listening. And have a lovely evening, Samarine.
You too. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.